It's Wednesday, the 19th of March, 2025, and this is Reconstruction, the Construction Index podcast with David Taylor and Phil Bishop, here to discuss some of the construction industry news emerging over the past couple of weeks. Most of the world news at the moment, Phil, seems pretty bad, but it's the vernal equinox tomorrow. I don't know if you knew this. So are you filled with the joys of spring?
I didn't. Vernal equinox. I know the clocks are going spring forward this weekend.
Ah, right. Okay. Well, that's why then.
So I imagine it's all part of the same thing. What does vernal mean? Is it something to do with...
It means spring.
Spring.
Vernal means spring, yeah. It's probably Greek or Latin. I don't know. But yeah, the vernal equinox, it's when you get equal amounts of darkness and light. So you've got 12 hours of daylight and 12 hours of dark. So that's why it's called an equinox.
Uh-huh. That makes sense.
Ah, there you are, you see. They'll all be flocking to, Stonehenge or somewhere like that, I imagine.
Yeah.
Yeah, probably. Or is that, that's midsummer, isn't it? They go there. Anyway, there's probably some druids out there doing something, you know, sort of thing that druids do. Anyway, I think that's enough of that. What are you going to talk about? Something a bit more down to earth, I think.
Well, I've got a couple of things on the agenda this morning, but I think the place to start, the big event, if you can call it that, we've been talking about it for a long time, but last week was finally the publication and first reading, second reading, anyway, publication, introduction to Parliament of the Planning and Infrastructure Bill, which is flagship piece of legislation from the government. And a lot of the elements of it we've talked before on these podcasts before, so I don't really want to go over what we've talked about before, like killing bats and newts and paying into an offset fund, you know, not having projects stalled and not having projects stalled by people lodging continual legal bids to block projects. So that in itself is I think we've pretty much covered, but it's all hand in hand with, which is kind of obvious when you come to think of it, it's all hand in hand with the whole government's deregulation drive and trying to, you know, builders not blockers, and trying to sweep aside anything that makes things difficult to get things done. And it makes actually the Labour government in so many ways indistinguishable from the Tories in terms of their policies and their starting points. You know, the Tories forever having their red tape initiatives. But the end trouble is the nature of bureaucracy is that it's a hydra. You chop off one head and another head crops up somewhere else. And so whenever the Tories tried to sort of cull quangos, two more sprung up. Things like the building safety regulator. No one was going to say, oh, that's a bad idea, because after Grenfell Tower, we must have more regulation. We can't let the construction industry get away with self-certifying, self-regulating and doing its own thing.
No.
If it's going to behave like this and, you know, tall buildings are going to catch fire. So there was no sort of opposition, particularly political opposition, to the idea of stronger regulation in the building industry after Grenfell and creation of this new quango, the building safety regulator. But conceptually, the Labour government, like the Tory government, want to see fewer regulatory bodies. And they're talking about merging some regulatory bodies. And the as part of this, I think Private Eye would call it the irony meter is broken again. To reduce the amount of regulation and bureaucracy, they've set up the Regulatory Innovation Office.
Introduced a new layer of bureaucracy, in other words.
But this is just the nature of things. But the one bit of bureaucracy which is under review, well, there's a couple of bits of health and safety regulation. They're talking about reviewing the agency is going to review the pressure systems safety regulations, which is a 25-year-old regulation, which I'm not hugely familiar with. Looked it up. It's to do with pipes carrying fluids, gases under pressure, not within your own house, but from one piece of land to another piece of land, from place to place. I don't really know. I can assume that they say these systems have got to be safe and looked after properly, etc., but I don't really know the details of that. I know rather more about LOLA, the lifting operations and lifting equipment regulations from 1998. And HC apparently is going to look to simplify LOLA, make it less prescriptive.
Do they say how they're going to simplify LOLA? Because
no, and I emailed the HSE yesterday to ask the question, and I rang them up this morning when I'd had no reply to my question, and I would just check right now to see if anything's come in from them, and no, it hasn't. No, and I'm not aware of LOLA. I mean, obviously, when it first came in, there's a big kind of, ooh, who's an appointed person? How do I get to be an appointed person?
Yeah, yeah.
And what's the definition of this? But after 25 years, it's proper bedded down, and you know, an industry of testing and appointed people and training and so on has grown up around it, and it's all. I haven't heard anyone in the crane world moan particularly about LOLA for a very long time. They seem to accept it as a fact of life.
So did anybody moan about it when it was introduced? I suppose they might have done if it was a new bit of bureaucracy, which is.
I think that was it. And I think that certainly a lot of cases, the case of there used to be in the olden days, well, it still should be actually, philosophically, if you talk about mobile cranes, and the LOLA's more than just mobile cranes, but let's just talk about mobile cranes. Things, or even tower cranes as well, I should say. Philosophically, the person at the controls was in charge.
Mm-hmm.
If the person is actually operating the crane, they decide what's safe and sensible, and you can't have anyone, any sort of, you know, site manager saying, you know, back it in here and just lift that over there. And if the crane, the crane operator's person who knows how the machine works and has, you know, read the instructions, sort of say, well, actually, it's too windy. We're not allowed to do it over a certain, you know, the manufacturer specification says can't do this or can't lift that
fast. Yeah.
I mean, you can't. Most modern cranes, the computer doesn't let you do anything dangerous. It, you know, it cuts out. You can't slew or jib into danger zones or whatever. But the introduction of the appointed person, I think that when it first came in, there was a bit of kind of like, ooh, does this mean the crane operator is no longer the supremo? But that is not what I think's on the table here. And this is why I asked the HC, who's driving for this? What's the agenda? Mm. What's wrong with LOLA? And they haven't come back to me. So I just Googled what's wrong with LOLA. And I could find no one really bitching or moaning about it, apart from on something called the Farming Forum and a big discussion about LOLA. Just from last year, some farmers saying, we had our health and safety consultant making his 6-monthly visit this morning. We got on to talking about LOLA inspections. And they're being told that it's not just, you know, they've got a telehandler that's got to be inspected as per LOLA, the harnesses, straps, they said the forks, the buckets, the shear grabs, bale squeezers, sand dispenser on the back of a tractor. That's been, and this farmer's like, sort of saying, hang on a minute. And someone else says, yeah, you're going to have your coffee mug will have to be LOLA'd because that's been used. You lift that to
you. You lift it with your...
and so there's some kind of... and other people came on and said, well, actually, a lot of that stuff is not under LOLA. That's under PUA, the provision and use of
work equipment.
Powered equipment, whatever it is. Yeah,
yes.
and there is a sort of certain... I don't know whether they overlap, but certainly one moves into the other. PUA, LOLA, you know, there are areas where they're closely related.
Yeah.
But the basic premise of PUA is LOLA is to make sure that you plan your lifting operations and the people and the equipment are all, you know, fit for purpose.
Yes.
And I can't imagine for a minute that HSE is going to change that. It's not going to suddenly say, you don't have to inspect your equipment. You don't. So all I can think of that it's suggesting is that maybe the paperwork, you know, maybe they're going to remove a couple of boxes on the forms that you have to add in
all
the books.
Or make it all electronic or something like that. Because I agree with you that I can't see anything wrong. In fact, you actually included quite a concise summary of what LOLA requires in your story that you posted about this. And I'll quote it. LOLA requires that all lifting operations involving lifting equipment must be properly planned by a competent person, appropriately supervised and carried out in a safe manner. Lifting equipment must be fit for purpose and subject to statutory, periodic, thorough examinations with records kept and defects reported. And I can't see anything in there that anybody would object to. It just seems like common sense to me. So I think it must be maybe the admin, the paperwork, as you're suggesting, that they're hoping to simplify, because they certainly can't change that, you know, the provisions outlined in that description, can they?
No, and I looked into the history of Lola, and funnily enough, the HSE is forever being told by politicians, you know, we want to make the state slightly less nanny-ish. And are there any you know, nanny-ish regulations that you can loosen so that we can look like we're deregulating, please? And I forget when, but 20 years ago or so, a long time ago, the HSE, Lola wasn't changed at all. What they changed was the guidance document. And I think they made the guidance document, they shortened it by a few pages. They made it easier to read. And they say, yeah, you know, we've made our Lola guidance simpler, probably just by, you know, using short words instead of long words. I don't know. But at least they were able to say, you know, yeah, we've ticked that box. We've made something simpler. We've made life easier for industry in general.
Yeah.
Less bureaucratic.
I can't see that there are going to be any massive gains made by doing something like that, though. I mean, how do you quantify the savings, either in time or, well, maybe in time if you've only got 12 pages to read instead of 60. But in terms of cost, I'm not sure that there's going to be an awful lot of benefit there.
Well, the one other thing on this topic the HSE is also going to review as part of this, you know, Whitehall deregulation drive is RIDDOR, the Reporting of Injurious Diseases and Dangerous Occurrence Regulation 2013. Basically, when you have an injury, an accident on site, you have to report it. You don't have to report near misses, which is a big weakness in the system, but then how do you define a near miss?
Yeah.
It becomes subjective, I suppose.
Yeah, yeah.
But they're actually going to consult on potential changes to definitions, occupational diseases and dangerous occurrences reported under RIDDOR. So that is, it's not changing the rules. You're still going to have to report it, but it's like, how do you report it, I think?
Yeah.
It's a bureaucratic process that you have to go through. And yeah, maybe, you know, you don't have to do it in triplicate in blue ink. You can use a black pen instead, or just do it online or something.
Yeah.
So I can't see these as being hugely deregulatory things.
No, I don't think they are. It's interesting, really, that they're sort of suggesting that they might water down or perhaps simplify health and safety regulations which have been in place for several years, while at the same time, you know, we've now got the Building Safety Act, which introduces all sorts of extra measures. Maybe it's just they're trying to balance things out a bit by cutting the burden here in order to make way for more burden in another part. But there was a chap from the HSE, actually, from the Building Safety Regulator, which is, of course, the body set up within the HSE to sort of basically police the safety of buildings, higher risk buildings.
Well, it's a building control body, isn't it?
The building control body is done by
high blocks of flats.
Yeah, but there was a meeting of the housing communities and local government committee in Parliament yesterday, and Philip White, who's the representative of the building regulator, gave evidence there, which was quite interesting. I had a look at it online, and I mean, he was explaining that. I mean, you wrote a piece recently saying that, you know, the Building Safety Act has basically slowed things down, that the whole process of getting projects on site has slowed down because of the requirements of the Building Safety Act. And that has indeed happened, because Philip White was saying that if you want to build a high-risk building, well, a higher-risk building, so it's above 7 metres or 18 storeys and it's got at least 2 residential units in it.
For the purposes of this podcast, can we just talk about high-rise? Because I think okay, high-risk yes. thing is a slightly annoying rise. Affectation. We're still talking about tower blocks.
This is all post Grenfell, of course. Yeah. So you have to jump through several hoops in order to get permission to either build a new high-rise building or carry out work to an existing high-rise building. And these are these so-called gateways. Gateway 2 is the key one, I think, at the moment, where you know, you have to submit your plans and they have to be approved before you can even start on site. So that's where I think the backlog has started to build up. And Philip White was saying that they still see, and I'm quoting him here, we still see quite serious failings in terms of us having to reject nearly 70% of building control applications for the Gateway 2 process. Well, you know, that's the majority. So basically, the people submit an application for work on a high-rise building, and 70% of them get knocked back because they don't comply.
Sorry, just to be clear, is it that they don't comply because they've not filled the form in properly, or are they not complying because it's a crap building, a dangerous building?
Well, the suggestion is that it doesn't comply. Basically, it's not just that the paperwork isn't correct. At least that's the impression I got. Philip White wasn't specific about this. He said nearly 40% of applications need to be validated before they're even assessed. So I know maybe people aren't actually following the procedure correctly. And so basically their paperwork isn't in order when they submit the application. I'm just reading my notes here.
While you look at that, I'm thinking of the analogy of the planning inspector for the nationally significant infrastructure project.
Okay.
The first thing they do is they put their development consent order application in.
Yeah.
And the first thing is the planning inspector either says, yes, we accept it, mm-hmm. we will now begin looking at it, or no, we don't accept it, go home and you know, fill right. in the blanks, which is what happened to Lower Thames Crossing the last time around. And so I guess I'm trying to get my head around whether the building safety regulator is not accepting the applications or whether it's turning them down.
Yeah, there's a fine distinction there, but I know what you mean. I think he's turning them down because he said as well that, you know, because you go along to have a look at the project. He said, when we go along to carry out assessments, we've seen during the first 6 to 12 months of the, you know, the regulations being in place, we see people struggling to understand their fire and structural safety risks in their buildings. So I think, you know, it's not simply that they, you know, they're not going through the process correctly. They're not following the procedure correctly. It's simply that they don't understand what they're supposed to be doing. They don't understand what their responsibilities are.
Now, this is hugely significant because the story you're referring to, which I ran yesterday, the day before, earlier this week, mm-hmm. was the minister responsible for building safety, Alex Norris, that's the chappy. Okay. He's got the building safety brief. He, responding to a written question, he replied to a question from a Liberal Democrat MP being asked about the blockage in the building mm-hmm. safety regulator process.
Approvals, and yeah.
He said, we're aware of it, it's getting better. We're getting more people trained up and it's all getting better. Because, I mean, the Construction Leadership Council had told MPs not very long ago that it was taking... roughly 24 to 22 weeks to get building safety regulator approval, and sometimes up to 40 to 48 weeks. So huge, you know, six to 12 months, basically, just to get it through this one regulatory, just through building control process.
Yeah.
And the minister's saying it's better now, and the building safety regulator is now looking at 16 weeks to clear Gateway 2. Now, if that's 16 weeks... is how long they're spending to approve to decide on things. That's all well and good if they're passing things, but if they're turning 70% of them down, as you said, or 60% of them down, that's 16 weeks. Okay, it's great that you're being said they say no to after 16 weeks, after 40 weeks or 28 weeks or whatever. But they're still saying no to a lot. So there's still a problem with the system that people are not, the developers, that I assume it is developers.
Yes, it is.
Know, are not, don't know the system. And
they don't know their system. I'll quote another thing that Philip White was saying yesterday about the Gateway 3 process, which is basically the sign-off. You know, once you've got your Gateway 2 approval, you can go ahead and do the work. But, you know, at the end of that, before you actually occupy the building, there's the Gateway 3 process, which basically is an assessment to confirm that the building does conform to the requirements. And he said that, he quoted well, he referenced one project in London. He said the developer thought that the building was ready to be occupied, but there were some serious failings in relation to fire and fire safety matters. And that's a building that had been put up since Grenfell. So basically, you know, it'd been built in the knowledge of what happened to Grenfell Tower and in all the tightening up of the requirements following that. So it was a new building, just been completed, and it didn't comply. And the developer thought, you know, we can move our tenants in. And clearly they couldn't, because it was non-compliant. So there's obviously a failure of understanding here.
There's a story I posted just today, Wednesday this week, of a developer converted an office block into flats, and he moved the residents in. This was before the building safety regulator regime came in. This is in 2022. This guy had done the conversion and got people moving in before he'd had the appropriate sign off from the fire authorities. And, you know, he basically jumped the gun. They hadn't had the certificate saying everything's fire safety compliant. And they forget his suspended jail sentence. Wow. Now, there's no suggestion here that there is anything dangerous about it. It's purely a bureaucratic process that he hadn't gone through. And it's important procedure that, you know, we want buildings to be certified as fire safe when you've got so many people living in them. But it wasn't that he left anything dangerous. It was purely the bureaucracy.
He hadn't followed the right procedures. Obviously there's a long way to go. And Philip White made this point in his submission yesterday, you know, that there have been improvements, and he didn't deny that there have been improvements. But he talked about culture change. And I think it's always a question of culture change when you need to change the way people go about their daily business. They need to change their approach. It's not just simply changing what you do. You have to think differently. He's talking about the building safety regulator has actually produced a draft guide on culture change. It didn't go into details about how you go about doing it, but he did point out that, you know, it is a top-down process, that you have to change attitudes right at the top and then sort of filter that culture change down through the organization. That's clearly not going to happen quickly. That's going to take months or probably years before an entire industry changes its outlook and stops cutting corners and stops doing things the way they always used to be done, because that's the way they always used to be done. So, you know, I think the fact is, I think because there is clearly a fundamental misunderstanding of the requirements brought in by the Building Safety Act, some people obviously have grasped it, but an awful lot of people clearly haven't. You're not going to see a sudden improvement in the situation, because these things take time to filter through.
Do we know how many projects we're talking about that are stuck in the system?
No, I don't. And that wasn't hinted at. I'm looking at my notes from what Philip White said yesterday. He talked about how the building safety legislation, there was aspects of that which could do with tightening up, changing.
Tightening up. See, that's the way people was talking. That's the way most people talk. We need to tighten. Whereas the government is all about, what can we loosen? What can we relax?
Yeah,
what can we sweep away?
Precisely.
And they won't, because, well, I mean, they might do a bit, but it's exactly the same as the Tories found. It's always, you know, one step forward, two step back. Yeah. For every one, you know, it's supposed to be, I think the Tories had a thing that we won't allow any new regulation until we've burnt one in its, you know, one in,
that's
one out.
Right, yes, yeah.
Yeah, but that it just didn't happen, didn't work.
Yeah. There was one thing which I thought made good sense, another point that Philip White made, which was about, you know, the HSE, they can descend on a site at any particular time, can't they, and issue an improvement notice or stop work or whatever. But he said, you know, the Building Safety Act only allows us to tackle issues building by building, which I think is quite an interesting point. He said, we can't tackle the employer. So basically he's saying, you know, a developer could have umpteen sites in London, you know, a big developer will have several sites on the go at once. He said, if we find problems at a particular building, we just deal with it there. But I'd like to be able to have the power to serve notice, any improvement notices, relating to training all employees. So basically, if he goes to a site, one site, and finds that there's a lack of compliance with the regulations there and people basically don't know what their responsibilities are, at the moment, he can say, right, well, you need to train these chaps up so that they know what they're doing. But the same thing could be happening on another site somewhere else, owned by the same developer. And that can just carry on. The HSE has to physically visit that site in order to make any changes there. He'd much rather go not to the site, but to the employer and say, sort yourself out, and I want to see improvements on all your sites.
That's got quite spooky implications, because if they have apply the same thing to, let's say, the work at height regulations, and you go on to, one, let's say, well, I won't pick anyone out, but, construction company X is one of their sites, and you find that the scaffold has not been tied properly, mm-hmm. And you serve an improvement notice, are you then going to say that work's got to stop on every site of that contractor or that subcontractor until they've...
I don't know. I assume that's what he's saying, that, I'd like to be able to slap an improvement notice on the employer, not just on the site. Issuing an improvement notice doesn't mean that you stop work on a site. It means that, you've got, we're going to go away and come back next month and you want to see improvements. So it wouldn't necessarily stop the work from happening. But I mean, they might say, right, we're going to stop work and then we're going to go to another site, one of your other sites, which we're not going to identify until we actually get there next month, and we want to see improvements there. And then presumably they can just descend on any of the employer's sites and expect to see an improvement. But it ties in with his point about culture change being a top-down process, that tackling it, if you like, on site, it's a bit like one of these systemic weed killers. If you want to reach the roots, you have to spray it on the leaves. So in other words, you've got to tackle the employer. You've got to tackle it at the top. And hope that it then trickles down, that they make the changes throughout the entire structure of the organization.
Should we move on to our second topic, David?
Yeah. Can't remember what it was. Remind me, Phil.
Well, we're going to talk about, about cement.
Ah, yes.
Again, we talk quite a lot about building materials and their—I didn't say their relative merits. Everyone knows what the merits of cement and concrete are. But also equally, everyone knows that it's got a image problem with its carbon footprint. Notwithstanding all the innovations and progress and cement substitutes, and I was struck by a couple of weeks ago got a press release from the Mineral Products Association, which is basically saying it's not fair. The government's got a strategy for steel, it's got a strategy for timber, and they don't care about us. They haven't got a strategy for cement and concrete or aggregates, and our quarry planning permissions are not being replenished as quickly as they need to be, and everyone hates us, but we're nice and we're doing really good things. And we've got exactly the same challenges facing us that the steel sector's got with cheap foreign imports and high energy costs and this, that, and the other.
Yep.
And it's just not fair.
Well, they've got a point, haven't they?
And I'm sure they have, but I don't know what they really want the government to do. To be honest, I read the timber roadmap and I didn't even report on it, because all it was saying is the government is saying, it's almost like, patting the timber industry on the head and going, you've got a nice product. Very good. We'd like to see more houses. More houses should be built of timber. We agree that more houses should be built of timber because it's a nice sustainable material. But that's not going to, make more houses being built of timber, because the government doesn't build houses.
Yeah. And I think most of the timber we use is imported anyway.
Well, I think Scotland, I read a stat and I can't remember what it was, but most houses in Scotland are built from timber, and I think that's probably mostly Scottish timber.
Well, things like OSB, you know, which of course is ubiquitous. It's everywhere. Oriented strand board, that's certainly produced in vast quantities in Scotland. You know, sheathing board and floorboards and sarking boards and stuff like that. But I don't think, you know, if talking about 9-inch beams and stuff like that, dimension timber, is there such a thing?
I think that's mostly structural
timbers and stuff. Yeah, I think most of that's imported. Actually, I don't think we grow trees big enough or enough of them. So I think a lot of it comes from Scandinavia and some of it from Canada, but could be a bit out of date on that. But anyway, yeah. So yeah, I think probably it's a timber's a nice renewable material. So the government wants to encourage more use of it.
See, I don't understand how all these materials used to get a lot with the steel framing and concrete framing for big office buildings. They're always in competition. The trade associations say, "Oh, steel's better than concrete." And, no, concrete's better than steel. And they're saying this. They've actually responded to the Mineral Products Association, the cement and concrete people, are saying the timber roadmap plainly states that timber is combustible and can contribute to spread of fire. So it's frustrating and perplexing. The government seems so keen to support using more of it. We don't burn. You should support us.
Yeah, exactly. That's a very old argument. Well, it sounds very obvious, doesn't it?
But my point is, I don't see it as a zero sum game. No. I think, you know, we want lots of construction and all boats float on a rising tide, is that it? You're not going to suddenly stop using, you know, cementitious materials. They're not going to disappear.
No, of course
not. I'd like to see more stone, more proper stone buildings. That's what I want to see. So I think, yeah, that's why we need a roadmap for proper, yeah, cathedrals made out of proper stone.
But they're right about foreign competition, although I think most of the British cement manufacturers are foreign anyway nowadays.
Well, yes. Which we talked about with steel as well. The steel industry is either Indian, Chinese, if you're talking about rebar, Portuguese.
Yeah.
And the cement is Swiss and German.
Mexican. Whatever.
Yes, of course. That's huge. Anyway, the CEMEX might be an interesting one because some bloke called Trump, who is the president of the United States, I think, has just slapped, was talking about slapping tariffs on, well, I think he has slapped tariffs on everything from Mexico and Canada.
Yeah.
And the suggestion that this is going to have an impact on cement prices worldwide. There's a statement from the founder of the World Cement Association earlier this month saying that overcapacity remains one of the cement industry's most pressing challenges. US needs to import cement. It has a net production deficit, and yet it's talking about or is imposing tariffs on cement imports. So it says that's just going to drive up prices.
Yeah.
Sure I see that, but anyway, it's going to drive up prices, and that's just going to have a knock-on inflationary impact. And the steel industry, the same thing, because the steel tariffs have gone ahead now in the USA, and we're not. UK has decided not to retaliate, but it's apparently already the steel and concrete cement prices are going to go up because of Trump. You know, we thought we'd had materials inflation under control, so that's. That's all about to head back again. But you mentioned the imports. Yes, I think you were going to talk about some new arrivals or new people targeting the UK.
Yes. You mentioned rebar being Portuguese. Well, there's a Portuguese cement producer, Simpor, who I've never really encountered before. They've set up, this is a story that you posted, they've set up a UK subsidiary, I think, in Bristol. Built a wharf actually to import the stuff, haven't they? So they're quite serious about muscling in on the UK market. And there was another incomer, a Turkish firm. These are the people with this rather special cement, actually, ultra white cement. They've got some tie up with Mannock. What did Mannock used to be called?
It's the Quinn Building,
Northern Irish firm. So they're Simsa. I don't, I keep wanting to pronounce that C as a CH. I don't know.
I'm going to guess it's Simsa.
Simsa, probably. As in, yeah.
I just discovered that I've been calling Holcim, Holcim for years.
Yeah, exactly. Well, yeah.
NMC
written down. There's no H in there, but I still want to put one in. Yeah, Turkish conglomerate. Sorry, Simsa is part of a Turkish conglomerate. Sabanci Holdings. Yeah, I'd never heard of them before, but yeah, it's a very special sort of stuff. So maybe that's just an addition to their product range and not really a massive, you know, new player on the UK market or the British market, being Northern Irish. Yeah, but it's interesting that they've decided to come in. They obviously see some market potential here in the UK.
But have you got that story open in front of you, the Simsa one?
I have, yes.
Have you seen the last two paragraphs? Cement imports have increased since Brexit. UK cement imports have increased from about a fifth of the market to a third.
Mm.
20 years ago, in 2003, 10% of cement sales in Great Britain were imports. That was Great Britain. It's now UK since 2014 to talk about. In 2019, when, you know, we'd voted for Brexit, we were still in the European Union the last year, 22% of domestic cement sales was imported.
Yeah.
And in 2023, the most recent figure we've got, 32% of cement is imported. Mm-hmm. So a third of our cement is coming from overseas. And now we've got Simsa from Portugal.
From Turkey.
He's got this dealership with Mannok. Mannok are selling the distributing the Simsa white cement. And Simpor from Portugal is targeting the UK and set up a UK company.
Mm, interesting.
And I bet there will be others, I'm sure. I think everyone will say, oh.
I mean, I'm assuming that most of these imports must be from mainland Europe. I mean, because, you know, as you said, the German and Swiss owners of our domestic production capacity, presumably they're importing as well to supplement their domestic production. Would that be right? Or is it coming from Mexico? Surely not.
I don't know, but my assumption is that you're absolutely right. That's how I would picture it,
yeah.
But I don't know. I can't imagine tanker loads of cement coming from Mexico.
Well, maybe they will now. If they can't send it to America over the border, maybe they'll send it over here.
Yeah, that's all. Yeah, I mean, the cement industry is clearly, or the indigenous British cement industry is clearly, you know, under threat from overseas competition, rising costs, and essentially a hostile political environment because it's seen as a carbon baddie. But of course, by importing more, all we're doing is exporting our carbon, basically.
Yeah, yeah. Well, yeah, exactly. Well, that's one of the ways we get our net carbon emissions down, isn't it? By getting somebody else to do it for us.
Yeah, which is bogus.
Yeah, of course it is. Yeah,
every other form of offsetting that we've been talking about. It's
yeah, 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 yeah. We're not fans of offsetting. And we're going to change the subject now. Talk about recruitment and training, because that's our third topic of the day. Quite an interesting story, actually.
Yeah, this was. I mean, I wouldn't particularly have reported on this, or wouldn't even registered it apart from the. You know, I would have just dismissed it as the ravings of an attention seeker. But the Plumbing and Heating Federation, which is what used to be called SNIPEF, they still are the Scottish and Northern Ireland Plumbing Employers Federation, SNIPEF. They've now, because that's a horrible, clunky name. They've now sort of a more snappy trading name, or using names, marketing names, Plumbing and Heating Federation, which is much easier to get your head around. But the Plumbing and Heating Federation sent out a press release a couple of weeks ago saying, "Ear, have you seen what this Russell Findlay guy's been saying? He's bonkers, he is. We think that's bonkers." And what Russell Findlay was saying, and this guy is...
You should point out who Russell Findlay is.
Okay. He's the leader of the Scottish Conservatives in the Scottish Parliament. My first reaction was, well, surely in Scotland, Conservatives are completely irrelevant, aren't they? So I looked at the composition of the Scottish Parliament and was quite gobsmacked to discover that they're the second biggest party. They've got far more than Labour or the Lib Dems in the Scottish Parliament.
Because a few years ago, they didn't have a single seat in Scotland, did they?
No, they didn't have a single... But I think, did they get down to none? They went down to one. In Westminster, because in Westminster, there are only... whatever it is, 40.
Oh, right. Oh, I see. Okay. But in the Scottish Parliament.
But in the Scottish Parliament, there's more of them, and therefore it's more diffuse. And
fair enough.
Anyway, in the Scottish Parliament, I don't think they're in any danger of winning control anytime soon, the Conservatives, but they are, you know, a proper major opposition party in there. Anyway, Russell Findlay said teenagers should be allowed to leave school at the age of 14 rather than 16. Should lower the school leaving age to 14 to allow young people to pursue a hybrid education and escape a system that isn't working for them, which is, it's an interesting thought. And anyway, Plumbing Heating Federation jumped on this and said, this is not just unrealistic, it's irresponsible. We have strict safety regulations. We can't have children wandering around on our sites. It was almost like he was suggesting we, you know, should send children back up chimneys again.
Well, they made points about how, you know, there is safeguarding. Of course, we never used to talk about safeguarding, but now safeguarding is you know, so ubiquitous. And if you have to take it into account with minors and somebody of age 14, yeah, you wouldn't let them just wander around on a site with a spanner or a soldering iron or whatever it is, unsupervised. I mean, the whole point of an apprenticeship is, of course, that when they're on site, they are supervised. And I think SNIPEF, or whatever they call themselves now, were saying that, you know, it's too much of a burden. You can't have somebody attached to this child, you know, looking over their shoulder all the time. But surely, you know, it's the way you manage it. You don't give a 14-year-old a particularly dangerous or responsible job on site. You get them to, I don't know, do the running around, the sort of back office stuff.
Make sure no one nicks the tools out of the van.
Yeah, that sort of thing. Or sort of, yeah, pass me that hammer sort of jobs. I mean, I it does seem a bit retrograde, I suppose, because, I mean, going back to the 1960s when kids could leave school at 14 and you know, go and start working on a building site. But I'm sure if it was managed properly, it would work.
Well, there is this, the whole, I mean, I my instinct is to agree with the Plumbing and Heating Federation that to allow children to leave school at 14. And we should clarify, this is only a proposal for Scotland, where they have their own, Scotland can do that. They can, where they can do their own thing. They're
devolved.
Devolved powers to set school leaving age. So they could go ahead and do that, even if the rest of the UK didn't do it. You know, I instinctively agree with the Plumbing Federation that it's a bit Victorian, it's a step backwards. At the same time, I do think it's a conversation to have, because part of the problem that the construction industry faces all goes back to, you know, the Blair Labour government of the 90s doing this education, education, education. We want everyone to go to university. And suddenly everyone's going to university from the, you know, the University of Uttoxeter or University of Keighley or whatever. And it's, oh, I've got a degree. Now I expect to be, given a top job.
Higher earner, yes, of course.
I'm not going to go work outside or wear overalls because I've got a degree. And degrees became completely undervalued. And we're just sort of not even educating people, because an awful lot a lot of university education is not, the education is less value than the time spent, how you spend your time there if you take advantage of what's on offer. But this suggestion from this guy Findlay from the Scottish Conservatives is almost like a flip away from that. Say, we've got to recognise that we've perhaps gone too far in the sending everyone to university. Yes. And what we need to do is get people who are better suited for it into trades as soon as possible. And the Plumbing Federation is saying, you've got to be good at maths, science and literacy to be a plumber, because you've got to be able to read the instructions and you've got to be able to do heat loss calculations and system design. Plumbers aren't stupid. You need an education. But I think you don't stop learning when you leave school.
No, of course not.
One of my favourite saying, every day's a school day. So the idea that a 14-year-old would leave school and not get any better at, or get any more knowledge of maths, or, you know, read any more books and would, you know, stop learning about science is stupid. And Finlay makes the point that talking about pursuing a hybrid education, there would be, certainly there would have to be, and this is what I would say, if you were going to let children leave school at 14, they would have to go to some sort of college or some sort of educational, you know, scheme on a day release, block release, whatever. They're not leaving it. They're not leaving education. They're just leaving school.
I think that's in a way, I suppose he's being a bit provocative by just coming out and saying that kids should be able to leave school at 14. But as you say, as a counterbalance to the sort of university inflation process where everybody goes to university and gets a useless degree is quite helpful because it turns everything on its head. I think, I mean, maybe you could still do a lot more practical work in school. I mean, maybe, you know, instead of doing modern languages and geography, you could just do plumbing or electrics or something like that. But I suppose you'd have to provide the facilities. No, I think I agree with you. You don't stop learning just because you're 14. I mean, you're learning probably at your maximum rate at that age.
Whether in school or not.
Yeah, whether in school or not. And in fact, I think, you know, within a school environment where you're learning things really on a sort of theoretical basis, it's maybe not as easy to learn that way for a lot of people as it is to actually learn by doing. You talk about heat loss calculations. That sounds very scientific. And I'm sure you could, you know, sit in a laboratory and do experiments and then do the calculations and all the maths involved. But out on site, actually seeing it in real life, that might actually bring it to life and help you learn about those things more readily. So, yeah, I think there's a lot to be said for hands-on working. And I've certainly thought for a long time that apprenticeships are undervalued and we really ought to promote them more. And, of course, there's lots of different types of apprenticeships. You can do degree apprenticeships.
And I think, and if someone can not take that course at 14, I think it's a lot harder. If you're, you know, 17 or something, you're thinking, ooh, my parents expect me to do A-levels to go to university, and I sort of sort of heading in that direction. There's some sort of pressure there. And there's still, wrongly, especially with degree apprenticeships, an idea that apprenticeships are for, you know, the B stream rather than the A stream choice. And if they can embrace that choice of apprenticeship before any kind of, you know, other pressures creep in, then it's perhaps not the done thing to do. I don't know where that stands, but comes into my mind now that program on Netflix, which everyone's been talking about and been getting rave reviews, called Adolescence.
I've been watching it. Yeah,
it is. It's a stunning program. But the second of the four episodes all takes place in real time, as a single shot, in the 14-year-old protagonist's school.
Yes, he's 14.
And that school is clearly an environment where it's just a case of it's somewhere to keep the kids off the street rather than somewhere to teach them.
Yeah.
You look at a lot of the children there. I mean, okay, a lot of them. Well, if you took out the ones who would be better placed going off into some vocational training apprenticeship situation, the ones remaining might be able to
Better chance of learning.
Yeah.
I mean, full disclosure here, my wife is a secondary school teacher, sort of semi-retired now, but maybe she would make the point that things have got an awful lot worse since lockdown. So there's been a massive change in behavior of school children since the COVID pandemic. Yeah, a lot of the time it is simply a matter of keeping the lid on things, and if the ones who want to learn manage to get ahead within that environment, then, you know, good on them. But the others are just, you know, they don't want to be there, they don't want to learn, they're not interested, and they disrupt it for everybody else.
So if they're earning a living, even at 14, you let them earn a living. Okay, their education as well, and it would be, you know, far less than minimum wage, but it's they're still living at home and probably not paying rent. You know, at least putting money in their pocket. I think there's an incentive for them to not muck around. You say, look, you do the work. At the weekend, you could buy yourself a new pair of trainers or whatever.
Sure, yeah. And I think in a work environment, things are, in a way, there's a different dynamic there between, say, your boss and between the worker and the boss than there is between a school student and a teacher. Because a school student isn't working for the teacher and they would resent any suggestion that they were. Yeah. They actually don't want... The teacher can sod off as far as they're concerned. But if that teacher becomes a boss, there's
different dynamic,
a change in status there. Yeah. And I think, it sounds a bit old fashioned, I suppose, but you do what the boss tells you. You can't turn around to your boss and say, F off, I'm not doing that. I'm going outside for a fag. Well, he said, fine, you haven't got a job anymore.
Back to school.
Yeah, back to school. I think there's a lot of merit in that suggestion, although I'm with you. I think it does seem a bit retrograde to let kids leave school at 14, but I don't think it shouldn't be dismissed.
We haven't even got a decent framework in place for 16-year-olds who want to go into vocational training.
Hmm.
So bringing it down 14 seems far too premature. If we had a decent system in place for 16-year-olds, which was working, and proven to be a good thing, I mean, it's a good thing where it works, but there's not enough of it. But if we had that then we could think about bringing it down to 14.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, we could talk about this subject for hours and hours and hours, because, of course, we haven't mentioned the parents and the home environment and how that influences kids' expectations and consequently their behaviour. That's another issue, but, it is important. Kids at school, if their parents don't care about their education, the kids won't care about their education. They both might care a little bit more about their career and their opportunity to earn money.
Yeah.
Government's been talking about just this week about changes to the welfare system and, increasing the threshold at which you can claim certain benefits and stuff like that. And there's a growing realization there that perhaps people have become too entitled, less incentivized to go out and work. Maybe it's the same with adolescents, that they just don't feel the need or the obligation to actually make anything of their lives.
So this is our message for the week then. Young people, pull your socks up.
Yes, that goes for all of us. Unfortunately, I've got a lot to do.
Okay, we'll call that a day, David. Thank you, everyone, for listening once again. And we will be back with you again in 2 weeks' time. But for now, from David and I and the Reconstruction team, goodbye.
Goodbye.
Thank you for listening to Reconstruction, the podcast from the Construction Index. To keep up to date with the latest construction news and headlines, please visit theconstructionindex.co.uk and sign up for our free daily email news briefing.